Hey, everybody, we are back with the That's Criminal podcast hosted by myself. That's Criminal is where we talk true crime, books, authors, writing, and just about whatever else that crosses my mind. Before I get into things today, I wanted to take a minute to thank Robbie and Terry and all the great hosts, readers, and writers for making last week's Space Coast Book Conference in Cape Canaveral, Florida, such a blast. And I get that that's a pun, and sorry, I just noticed it, Cape Canaveral. We got a lot of great feedback on Blood Red Ivory while I was there. People seem to really be enjoying the first Ty Benhoff adventure. More to come on that, but thank you to everybody who gave me those good feedback. Also, it was great to spend the majority of the week talking books with like-minded people, so that was awesome. And I'll be doing the same thing again in September at Books at the Beach in Clearwater, Florida. If I'm not mistaken, tickets are still available for that, and you can check out their website, just a quick Google. Today, I'm very excited to talk with Dr. Joni Johnston. Dr. Johnston is a clinical forensic psychologist, private investigator, and crime writer who found her interests in the dark side of human nature after reading Helter Skelter, Vincent Bugliosi's book about the Manson family when she was 14. She has spent her professional career working in prisons, forensic hospitals, and courts, and has worked with both offenders and victims. She also has a passion for communicating forensic psychology to the public, writes a blog for Psychology Today called The Human Equation. She has a YouTube channel called Unmasking a Murderer and a podcast, Behind the Mask. She's a mom of four, a foster mom to dozens of animals, and loves to work out, read, and visit historical places. Me too. Her book, Serial Killers, 101 Questions True Crime Fans Ask, I found it to be fascinating, and it dragged me right down the rabbit hole. She takes fan questions from her various platforms, uses them as its own springboard to do a deep dive on many issues surrounding the phenomenon of the serial killer and why we are so fascinated by true crime. So I'll start by saying this. I thank everyone, Joni, that comes on to take the time to come and join me. But after learning about all the things you're into, it might be better to say thank you for joining me. But also, how did you find time to squeeze me in? I didn't even mention your professional practice. But wow, you have a lot going on. So welcome to That's Criminal.
Well, I am really excited to be here. And I really do like talking about true crime and forensic psychology and, you know, all the different issues those raise and how we can talk about these kind of topics in an ethical way, in a helpful way, and those kinds of things. And so I was really impressed by your background. I listened to a couple of episodes and thought, wow, this guy's a great interviewer. So it was not that difficult to find time to come on and talk with you.
Thank you for the kind words. I appreciate that. To start, being a forensic psychologist, I think I'd like to jump in right there because people can often hear, you know, the term forensic psychologist, but it's kind of hard sometimes putting those two terms together because forensics kind of works backwards and psychology, you know, studying the human mind backwards, if you think of it that way. So would you mind giving us a kind of a look into what it's like to be a forensic psychologist?
Absolutely. Well, one thing I should say is I am a very biased, have a biased perspective because I absolutely love what I do. So I think it's like one of the best jobs in the entire world. But basically a forensic psychologist is somebody who is a psychologist who specializes in really any situation where there's a legal question that needs some kind of psychological expertise. And so it really is pretty broad. I mean, it could range from, I know in the recent Johnny Depp Amber Heard trial, there were a couple of forensic psychologists who evaluated Amber Heard. It could be somebody who is claiming emotional distress as part of an automobile accident. And so they go see a forensic psychologist. And the question is, A, is this person emotionally damaged or distressed? And if so, is it because of their car accident? All the way to somebody who is a defendant in a criminal trial and they're pleading not guilty by reason of insanity. So it's extremely broad. I tend to focus on the criminal arena. That's kind of my bailiwick, but it's much broader than a lot of people think that it is. It's just, like I said, it's just bottom line, when you're a forensic psychologist, you do primarily evaluations, not as much treatment, and you are trying to answer some legal question or provide information or input about it.
Applying behavior to an event to see if there's a correlation.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And also a lot of times, you know, it's because we're kind of scientists, we're comparing the defendant to other people who are in that same category to see, does that person fit? So for example, if I'm evaluating a defendant who's claiming insanity at the time of a crime, I'm going to be looking very specifically at all the things around the offense. You know, how was this person, what do witnesses say? What do police reports say? What does this person's psych history say? What do people who knew him say? What is his family saying? But I'm also going to be looking at, you know, his bigger picture history and looking at, okay, if this person has a certain diagnosis or certain symptoms, what's the likelihood, looking at the research, that people with these symptoms are likely to be violent? So it's kind of both of those.
Yeah, and it's as I was reading, it's not only we'll get into the book in a second, but it reminded me, I've had limited experience in my career with the forensic psychologist. I think the most in-depth one I ever did was an allegation of child abuse, and mm-hmm. it was, and I never had the appreciation for it, as I worked a bunch of crime scenes, and mm-hmm. the detail and the capture of the circumstances of a crime scene I've applied to elements and the prosecution in the past. But what I found when I worked with the forensic child psychologist, they've got the victim there that they need to talk to through a very, very filtered mechanism to make sure there's no bias, make sure they're not feeding them anything. But the importance of the detail on the small parts of the statements and the investigative reports and all that stuff that can very easily be overlooked and left out of a report was very important to them in formulating their game plan and how they actually tried to extrapolate, you know, apply those events to what they were gaining from that child in that case. And I hate to use the term fascinating because it's incredibly sad on the outside, but to watch that technical work taking the importance of that, the detail oriented reporting and applying that, that's an extremely difficult job, I would imagine.
It is. I mean, I think, you know, people who are working crime scenes, to me, and maybe that's why I'm a forensic psychologist and not a crime scene investigator, that to me is so much more difficult, and from an emotional standpoint and all different kinds of ways. But I will tell you, those police reports, those witness reports, those initial statements can just be so valuable, especially if we're being asked to somehow reconstruct a person's mental state, or if we're trying to gather information, particularly from a child, for example, as a witness, because those early statements, those early interviews are oftentimes the most credible, as we know. And so things can change over time, not necessarily for diabolical reasons, just because memory can be contaminated and we know those kind of things. And so there's times when I read things and I'm just like so thankful that investigators were writing these things down, these observations, and having the opposite experience when I'm reading something and trying to figure out, and it's just kind of a rote report of the facts without any sense of what it was like for these individuals who were interacting either with a victim or interacting with an offender.
Yeah. And it struck me when I was doing my research is those immediate statements, that first interview, depending on the circumstances of the case, it could be such a high level stress event that, you know, you might be trying to focus on your victim or your witness, and you've got six people calling you for an update so they can brief command or they can brief the executive team, and 100 different things going at once. And it's so easy to miss that. And it's one of those things that chills down my spine and be like, wow, you know, it's so mm-hmm. easy to take away the tools from you guys. And it just, that hit me as I was reading on some of this. You said that, you know, you spent your time as a forensic psychologist working with victims and perpetrators. The relationship that goes into that, because you have to spend time with these people. As far as the relationship and rapport of getting a prisoner or somebody who's facing charges to honestly answer. Because I mean, depending on the level of experience a criminal has, they already know the answers you're looking for to get the outcome that they want. How do you balance the manipulativeness of an experienced offender against defining the actual truth that you're getting from them?
Wow, there's so many different ways to go with that question. I'm not even sure, like, I could go like three different paths. So I'll try to go down maybe a couple of different ones, you know. So one is, I started, when I first got out of school, I did work with offenders and and with victims primarily. So I did a lot of therapy with children who were incest survivors, who had been taken away from the home because of physical abuse or, you know, sexual abuse or neglect, and, you know, was either helping them, obviously trying to heal. Also, of course, there was also a legal component to that in terms of, I would often be asked to testify of what I observed. And sometimes, in some ways, sadly, but in sometimes necessarily, testifying about things like parental termination of parental rights and those kinds of things. And so I got a real trial by fire, in a way, look at just trauma in children, because a lot of times these kids had just been taken away. And so, you know, trying to navigate that. So I'm so grateful to have that experience, because as you and I both know, the victims can get lost in these situations. And so I love that. And then I began doing more work with offenders. And so, depending upon what the question is, one of the distinctions between a forensic psychologist and a clinical psychologist. A clinical psychologist, if you come into my office as and I'm a clinician, and you tell me, you can tell me all kinds of things. You can make up a bunch of lies. And really, as a clinician, my job is to see the world the way you see it and to help you navigate that, problem solve, figure out. I'm going to be asking you kind of probing questions about what you're telling me, but I'm not going to be calling up your wife and saying, you know, John said this, is it true? Or what is your perspective? Or what evidence do you have that you were late for work and you got a ticket? Can you bring the ticket in so I can validate that it was on this date? So we have a lot of tools as forensic psychologists in looking at outside data. And so I always look at outside data. So I make it very clear, if I'm evaluating somebody who's up for parole, I'm evaluating somebody who's gotten in trouble inside of a prison. And the question is, did this person's mental illness influence that person's behavior? And if it did, should their sentence or their punishment be less, and those kinds of things? I'm going to be not just talking to that inmate. I'm going to be talking to the custody officer. I'm going to be talking to people he was around to get a sense of, you know, kind of the totality of the circumstances. And so that is very important as a forensic psychologist, never to take somebody at face value. And there's no judgment associated with that. But I mean, when you're in trouble, you know, you're facing prison time, you're facing the hole or whatever it is, there's a lot of motivation to, you know, present yourself in the best possible light or distort facts or those kinds of things. It is amazing, though, because I always tell people that I'm evaluating, look, I want to make sure that you understand the context of this. This is not a therapy session. I have access to your medical records. I have access to your legal records, your C file. And so just want to give you a heads up about that before you tell me a bunch of stuff that might not be true. I don't normally say the last part, but it's implied. And, you know, I learned pretty quickly that, you know, sometimes it doesn't matter. I mean, people will still sit there and tell you, you know, what they think you want to hear. So it's very important to always look again at all the objective kinds of things. So, you know, one of the myths I think that I run across a lot is that a lot of people try to fake insanity. They try to fake like they're, quote, crazy to get off of, you know, and there've been people to get off of a charge. And there've been certainly been individuals who've tried to do that. Ken Bianchi, who was one of the Hillside Stranglers, was kind of famous for developing all of a sudden after he was arrested what he called multiple personality disorder, which we call dissociative identity disorder. Well, people who are genuinely insane legally at the time of a crime, there's almost always an extensive history long before this crime happened of somebody who has, you know, had psychotic breaks, who's been on psychotropic medication, who's often been hospitalized, sometimes involuntarily. So, you know, that data tells you something. Now, we also know that people who have a severe mental illness, number one, are not, they're not likely to be violent. So that doesn't mean that person is violent. There are certain symptoms that are better predictors of violence than diagnoses. So, and we also know that people who have a severe mental illness also get really pissed at people they care about, you know, so just because you have a severe mental illness doesn't mean that had anything to do with your crime. So it's complicated, but we do have some, you know, other data, and it's very important to rely on that data as part of the interview. It's very difficult to pretend to be severely mentally ill, even inside of a prison 24 hours a day.
Yep.
I am convinced that people can lie to me and lie to me convincingly. I don't have that big of an ego that I think I can spot a liar a million. There's tons of data to show not true, but to, you know, to maintain that 24 hours a day over a period of time is very difficult to do.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just that occurred to me as I was putting this together, because, you know, oftentimes we'll see it in the news, you know, a guy goes out and commits a heinous crime and he just got on parole like a week ago. And it's, they always go back and saying, how could the parole board do this? You know, mm-hmm. And it's one of those things. I think it's important for people to understand when it comes to doing those kind of evaluations. I mean, there's a lot that goes into it. People put it's not just one guy sitting on a parole board that it wants to open up bed space and just kicks people mm-hmm. to curb. There's a lot that goes into it, and you can't, you know, human behavior is not something you can often quantify. So, but yeah, I just thought it'd be interesting to get your take on what all goes into doing that evaluation. Cause I've just had people just, you know, you walk into the room, especially if they're in a controlled environment, and they spot you and they know exactly what checks to hit on the boxes to get the answer that they think that you want to make you go away. And it takes a lot of reps and a lot of circling around to get to the truth.
You're absolutely right. I mean, it can be feel like a dance sometimes. And, you know, you have to be aware of kind of the different steps and there are different dances and those kinds of things. And, you know, again, we build in as many safeguards as we can. You know, the other thing I think that's always a big question is that, you know, what is the purpose of our criminal justice system? So if somebody has been in prison for 30 years, for example, for a terrible crime, and this person has been, let's say, a model inmate for those 30 years, and yet you look at the crime and you go, this person should never be out. I mean, they killed somebody and this person who's dead is never going to have a chance to, you know, so then it becomes, okay, what is the purpose? Is it punishment? That's a valid argument. You can say that. I mean, there's no right or wrong answer necessarily. If it's just punishment, then the argument can be made and has been made and has been successfully pursued that this person should get life without parole and never get see the light of day. If the purpose is partially rehabilitation, and you're looking at this, you know, we all know that 30 years down the road, this person is not the same person they were 30 years ago. Now, they could be worse, I guess, or they could be, you know, the same in some ways. So we have to look at all those different factors. And what we hear about are the unfortunate situations where somebody's been let out and then they reoffend. Or they cut off their ankle monitor and go on a rampage or whatever. And, you know, unless we want there to be zero risk, which is another argument for keeping up, you know, people behind bars, they've committed horrible crimes. There's going to be a certain amount of risk. We just have mm-hmm. to reduce it as much as we can.
And as a society, we need to keep that in mind, is that we are not excising people from society. We believe in the potential of rehabilitation. And as you mentioned that, I was listening to some other interviews that you've done, and you mentioned, I think it was Eric Smith out of Binghamton, mm-hmm. New York. Mm-hmm. And it struck me because I remember I was maybe 8 or 9 when that hit. And that was kind of one of the first, like, 13-year-old did that type of things. Like maybe mm-hmm. I was 9 or 10 and mm-hmm. I was like, wait, did I just hear that correctly? And you mentioned that you got to look into his parole and his growth or evolution over time. And you're absolutely right. A 13-year-old is not the same after they spend 30 years in prison, you know?
And you know, that's such an interesting case that you brought up, John, because for a couple of different reasons. So I was interviewed for 48 hours about this case. And I was so lucky in the sense that I was able to review, as you alluded to, all of his parole hearings as part of that, which is something, you know, normally most people don't get to see. And there were so many takeaways for me about this. So clearly he is not the same person he was at 13. And yet when I looked at his, like you were saying, his evolution over time, to argue that at 21, you know, he should have been charged as a juvenile and released at 21. When you look at his parole hearings, I mean, he was frightening at 21. So I do not think in this particular case, now I wasn't sitting in on there, but I got to read the transcripts. it was really until he was well into his 30s that you do start seeing, you know, and he had some, this one program that he was in for 4 years that really did seem to have a positive impact on him. It wasn't until his late 30s that you started seeing this guy really start understanding, I think, emotionally as well as intellectually what he had done and starting to turn his life around in some respects. And so that opens a whole can of worms, right? When you have these youthful offenders, you know, it doesn't mean because you're 13, you should necessarily get out at 21 or 25. But I also think, and this is a personal opinion and professional opinion, that it is rarely, if ever, indicated that somebody who kills, you know, somebody at 13 should get life without parole. I'm fine with saying, okay, after 30 years, we'll review your case. Yeah, I mean, that's a long period of time. I'm not saying they should be tried as juveniles, but I do think there should be an opportunity at some point in time to have that case revisited.
Yeah, that continuing monitoring and actually documenting these people, that's a lot of resources.
It is a lot of resources.
You know, that I think sometimes we societally kind of fall through when it comes to mental health, especially in the criminal justice system, you know, giving those people the care that they need, or actually trying to get ID for early intervention in circumstances. I don't know how you would spot Eric Smith when he's 9 and say that you've got trouble coming. I don't know how we would be able to have a blanket mechanism in our society to do that. But I mean, I think that's that kind of early intervention would help mitigate things, but I don't know what kind of mechanism would be there to do that. But you mentioned, as you mentioned this, the you know, horrible crime, you go to jail, never to be seen again. I had Rod Sadler on, who investigated Eastern Michigan serial killer. I want to say his name was Miller. But as the investigator or part of the investigation, he worked in that community long after, like, this guy got picked up when he was only a few years on the job. Mm-hmm. But he got to watch that the guy got through plea deals and anything else they wanted to do to get a conviction. They never actually charged him multiple homicides. They charged him manslaughter, whatever else they could get to get a plea. So he's actually eligible for parole coming up relatively soon. And Rod explained how he's watched, you know, not only to see this guy through time, because he's met with him and he's met with his family, but also to watch the impact on the victims who have to go every time his parole comes up and relive the entire thing over and over again. That's a lot, but I don't know how you would do things to mitigate that, either for the victims or to keep an eye on somebody like a Smith or a Miller to see when that line is, you know, are you worth bringing back into society? And I don't know how you have a mechanism there to watch for that.
Yeah, I mean, it comes down to, like, we're talking about all the data that comes together. I do think you're right. And I think it's always trying to find some balance in terms of not re-victimizing and re-traumatizing the families, because you're absolutely right. I think in New York, they had you were up for parole every 2 years. And so for over 20 years, this family, every 2 years, got all of this stirred up. You know, they didn't have to, but of course they wanted to, felt compelled to write letters. And I don't think in New York you could actually go and testify, but in some states you can actually go and present before the parole board. I know that there's been a couple of attempts to pass bills that lengthen the amount of time that you're eligible for parole. So I think New York actually, and I think actually Eric Smith's family is very much active in this campaign to change this every 2 year parole eligibility to 5 years. So that might be one way to, you know, find some happier balance between a family who's already grieving. And, you know, as we all know, grief is a lifelong process. It might get better, but it doesn't end. And there, you know, you're grieving not just what happened, but what's not going to ever happen, whether it's grandchildren or, I mean, just depending on what the situation is. So it is, they're such complex issues. Yep.
Yeah. And I think Smith in particular probably came up before those victim impact, the victims' rights and advocacy laws that kind of hit later in the 90s. And now, I mean, well-meaning, but also made people, forced people into ripping that bandage off, you know, every however many years. So it's, yeah, that's not an easy world to navigate. So I appreciate that. I really think the world of the forensic psychologist, I think people might have an outside idea of it, but it's different when you know, they think psychologists, they're thinking a couch. They're not thinking you get to go in with a case file and check this person out and determine whether or not all the, you know, all the world of variables fit, you know, that line of questioning or that person's outlook. So that's a fascinating job you got. I'm jealous.
So it's so interesting. And I will tell you, which is a really interesting and wonderful thing for me is that, and I always tell somebody that I'm evaluating is, look, I am part of this pie. So as you alluded to, my opinion will carry some weight and hopefully it'll carry good, you know, substantial weight if I'm doing a good job and doing my due diligence, but ultimately it's the parole board or it's the judge or whatever who makes that decision. And so I'm happy about that, you know, that I'm not the one who has to swing the gavel or, you know, be the parole board. They're the ones who really have the difficult job of making that final decision.
Yep. Yeah, it's a team effort. And, but, you know, the people, you know, every now and then when they hear that, you know, just got paroled, went out and did some heinous thing, they just want to blame and they don't understand the mechanisms that go into that. So I think it's important to discuss that.
Wouldn't you? I mean, if somebody that I loved was murdered by somebody who had just gotten out on parole, I would be beyond furious. I mean, I would be one looking for somebody to blame and trying to figure out what went wrong and change that and all that. So it's completely understandable.
Yep. Just natural reaction. I want to jump into your book, and I'm going to tell you right now that I kick off reading it and I'm like, this is a very easy read. I mean, that, you know, whenever, you know, not often, but, you know, if you see PhD or doctor in front of somebody's name, you can flip the page and it's written for a PhD student or it's written very easy to understand. It's written for somebody like me, very lowest common denominator. Yours, I was just flipping through. I mean, it's written in such a natural way that there is, it's just written for the common audience, and it's so packed with information. I will fully admit to information overload as I was getting into your book. Like, I was getting to the point, I was like, I'd read one question and I'd be like, well, what about this? And then I'd see your table of contents. I'd be like, well, let me jump over here. You know, I got a little schizophrenic jumping back and forth. I was like, well, what about this? And I would jump over here, jump back. But it's fantastic reading. It's just the premise, and you can go into further detail, but the 101 questions, serial killers, 101 questions, true crime fans ask. When I first saw the title, I was like, you know, what's gonna be fun. I'm going to see if she wants to come on and I'll have her quiz my wife and I, and we'll see how many questions we can get right. And then I start reading it. I'm like, oh no, this would not work, because that question, you use those questions as a springboard and then jump into research and jump into very, you know, we're not retreading true crime here. You're digging in and you're explaining these questions that people often have. And I just would like, give me some background on what went into doing this.
Well, it was really a fun book to write in so many ways, and I really can't take much credit for it, because you've already alluded to, I've been doing a blog for Psychology Today for, gosh, I don't know, over 10 years, maybe 12 years at this point. And I've been very lucky to have a group of readers who have followed my writing through the years, and I do some other things as well. But you know, you mentioned Helter Skelter earlier. When I was a senior in high school, Ted Bundy also escaped prison in Colorado, as you know, or jail in Colorado, and made his way down to Florida. And the Chi Omega house at FSU was about 80 miles from my house. And I was a senior in high school, so I was, you know, about the same age as some of the women that he killed. And so I think that really started my interest, because I just couldn't understand it. That was the thing. I couldn't understand why you would want to hurt people you didn't even know. I mean, they haven't done anything to you. And so that kind of started my interest in serial killers, you know, many years ago. And then I get, of course, I'm not alone. there are many people who are interested in serial killers, especially over the past 5 years, it seems like. And so I just started keeping a little journal or a little diary of different questions that I was getting from my readers. I don't always write about serial killers, but I almost always write about violent crimes. And so whenever I would get a question about serial killers, I would just kind of write it down, thinking at some point, because I didn't know all the answers to these questions. I mean, some of them were really complicated questions. And particularly when we're talking about international serial killers, which I've always been kind of interested in, I was like, I know that there are them, but I haven't really done a research. And so I really spent the time over COVID really just kind of researching that and kind of going, I'm just going to answer these questions in the best way that I can. So, and put it in one place. And initially I just thought of it as something I could, as a reference guide. And then a publisher approached me and said, hey, I think this would be a great book. And that's kind of how it came to be.
Yeah. You mentioned the international side, reading that, the cultural eccentricities that were at play when you compare, you know, I don't know whether it's a blitz offender over in America or a guy who, you know, kidnaps, you know, like gets somebody into the van and then, you know, jumps them, stuff like that. There was one example in India, the guy using the shame of like an unwed mother to convince a woman to take cyanide. And that was like the mechanism. I was like, the cultural aspects of that conflict with the US so much. It's very interesting to read what the motivations were and what the mechanisms were in that, and in a completely different culture. I was like, man, I could dive real deep into this, just looking at serial killers in other cultures.
It was that is one of the most interesting things to me, John, because it does say so much, I think, about different societies, not in terms of creating individuals. There's no societal excuse for, oh, this society created this serial killer. But I think what it does tell us sometimes is who we value and who is a society we tend not to value, and who the vulnerable groups are in different societies, because oftentimes that's who serial killers will prey on. And so, for example, you're exactly right. Mohan Kumar, which is who you're talking about, who is the Indian serial killer, his kind of MO, as you alluded to, was he would target women who were, a lot of them were in their early 30s, which is kind of becoming a quote old maid in India. There's a lot of pressure to get married still. And there's still a dowry system in some parts of India. And these were women whose families were impoverished, couldn't afford a dowry. And he had a government job and he would basically approach these women and troll for these women and woo them and, you know, and kind of in secret. Want to marry them, tell them he, you know, was in love with them. He had no interest in a dowry, which was, I mean, just, I can't even imagine what a relief that would be if you're having all this pressure to get married and there's all these issues. Yeah. And then he would tell them, we're going to elope and get married. And so be sure you bring your finest material, your jewelry, whatever you were going to bring, you know, wear it. And he would take them to a hotel. Then he would convince them to basically have sex with him because we're going to get married the next day. It's fine. And yeah. Then the next day he would say, you know, you got to take a birth control pill because the last thing we want is for you to, you know, for this to be known that we had, and he would give them this quote birth control pill that was cyanide. And that's just so diabolical. It's just so heartbreaking on so many different levels. And you're right. That would never happen in the United States because we have just a different frame, we have our own, you know, vulnerable groups for sure. But that wouldn't happen here. So it's fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if his motivations would fit into our same categories or his predilections, but it was just, but the mechanism alone is just alien. When I was reading it, I was like, that's fascinating to see how that works in other places. But yeah, when you mentioned the vulnerable populations, it reminded me of Native American populations. And I remember giving I was working with a bunch of other writers, just kind of answering law enforcement questions if they had some kind of scene building in their book or something like that. And somebody threw out like the Gabby Petito case or something like that. Mm-hmm. And it was in just cases like that, they just skyrocket so fast. Mm-hmm. Well, when there's scores of vulnerable females disappearing every day. And I just mentioned, I kind of made people mad when I just highlighted that contrast as we're discussing it. Just, you know, she automatically isn't on Good Morning America for a week, and there's hundreds of girls going missing that don't even come close to getting that kind of attention. That's a real problem that we have even in America, we still have that problem. You know, they're preying on those vulnerable populations, and those populations might not have the media influence that others do. So that's a painful one. That doesn't always make us look all that great, but
it is painful. But you're right. I think we all have our, I guess I can call them blind spots, or, mm-hmm. you know, because I don't think a lot of times the media is sitting back in a room kind of going, okay, we're looking for a blonde haired, blue eyed, attractive victim. It's even scarier in a way, because it's this kind of unconscious. We just somehow are communicating this person's more valuable by covering this. And that's something I think we are making progress, and there's been a lot more awareness that we are, you know, that we as a society are unfair in how we cover and present different missing people or different crime victims, but we have a long way to go.
Yeah. I wasn't intimating that it was intentional. Right. It was just, no. If you see a, you know, somebody looks like a cheerleader from Friday Night Lights going missing, that everybody's thinking about it, you know, and it's just the media's job to follow that. It's a blind spot that culturally is, I think you're right, it's getting better, but I think it's shining a light here and there. But looking at, you know, the internet, as you talked about the international side of things, you mentioned, you know, there's no one thing that goes into building a serial killer, and you start out right with that. You know, I mean, I think your first category was, you know, statistically, demographically, you just explained, you know, how is it, you know, there is no one thing that goes into making a serial killer. It's kind of a more gestalt, I guess, you know, totality mm-hmm. of the circumstances, mm-hmm. Which I don't think everybody always likes, because they like the idea of, okay, this kid just strangled a squirrel, he's going to be a serial killer someday. Let's keep an eye on him. You know, they don't like the fact that you can come from suburbia and end up being, you know, committing horrible crimes. I think it adds to that fear factor. When you tell people that, sorry, we don't have a profile, you know, I think profile is one of the most abused words in the English language, but it's that much scarier when you can't quantify what button somebody pushes to make somebody a serial killer.
Absolutely. And I think I've heard it described as a perfect storm in terms of what creates a serial killer, or a recipe for a serial killer. So I think we're getting a better sense of some of the ingredients that go into making a serial killer. But number one, serial killers are so diverse. I mean, in terms of their motives, in terms of demographics, in terms of all kinds of things. And, you know, we think serial killers, and who do we think about? We think about Ted Bundy. We think about John Wayne Gacy. We think about Gary Ridgway. We think about these sexually motivated, you know, white men for the most part, and without realizing that there are, you know, all different kinds of motives, all different kinds of, you know, of people who commit serial murder. I mean, as a matter, you know, the definition of a serial killer is somebody who's killed two or more people in separate occasions. It's pretty broad. I mean, it doesn't take a lot to kind of fit into that category. And so when we talk about what makes a serial killer, you know, we know, for example, that there's an overrepresentation of people with abused backgrounds that are serial killers. And yet you and I also know there are most people who are abused never hurt anybody else, much less become serial killers. And in fact, we probably know people who had terrible childhoods and they were like phoenix rising from the ashes. There are people who transform that pain into helping other people. And so we have all these ingredients that tend to be more represented than others, but there's exceptions to every rule. And it does seem to be, like I said, this kind of perfect storm that lines up, that makes somebody, you know, cross that line and begin to kill other people.
Yep. Yeah. And you lay it out in a great way. And I'll admit, it was funny when you started answering the question, you're like, okay, Bundy, Gacy, all these sexual predators. Mm-hmm. But you met, and it caught me for a second as I'm reading that beginning of the book, when you laid out motivations, you went into money, revenge, all these other things. And I was like, I completely did not even consider, like, yeah, absolutely, greed as a motivator for serial killer. I mean, the stereotype is so well set on these sexually sadistic people, mm-hmm. That, yeah, money. I mean, the lady, it put me in mind of the lady, I think, in Oregon or Washington that ran a halfway house, just started burying people in the backyard for insurance yeah. money. Serial yeah, killer.
Dorothea Puente, yes. Who, yeah. Yep. Mm-hmm. He would have yep. these rumors, you know, borders who started dying off. One by one, you know, I mean, yeah, my money is right up there, you know, in the top three for sure in terms of, but you're right. We don't tend to think of those individuals who with those motives as being serial killers. But in fact, when you're talking about, you know, being in danger from a serial killer, you're probably more in danger for somebody who's money motivated because they're more likely to kill people they're close to. Yep. They can get money from.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's right in front of us too, but people don't think about it. When you put that blanket term serial killer out there, there's a lot more people killed for their wallet every year than they are killed for some sadomasochistic, you know,
definitely,
you know, weird, you know, trip that some dude's on. But yeah, it's funny as I was reading, I was like, oh man, yep. I fell right into that stereotype. Like I see serial killer, I start thinking Dahmer. I don't think, you know, the serial armed robber who's just going around shooting people for their wallet. It still fits the category. But so as you went into the demographics, the statistics and all the different ways that lays out, you explain it so well that all those people that really, really want to hold on to that trifecta, and I forget the name you applied to it, of, you know, what you wet the bed, you start fires, you beat your cat, you're going to be a serial killer. It's yeah. You explain that so well that there's a ton more variables that go into it. It's very educational.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Yeah. And it's easy to digest, which I really, you know, really liked, because when in your bio, when it says you first read Helter Skelter, for me, it was Mindhunter. John Douglas, yeah. About the same age when that came out. And just because I remember when I was 8 or 9, Shawcross was working in Rochester, and and as a little kid, you know, mom and dad aren't going to talk serial killer with you, but you know, even where I lived out in the sticks, it was, you know there's a maniac killing people in Rochester, you know, mm-hmm. type thing. Yeah. And yeah. but it's like wait a second. So you'd hear it when the adults don't think you're there, and like, what do you mean a maniac's killing people in Rochester? That doesn't make sense. It doesn't compute to an 8-year-old, you know.
Definitely not.
But yeah, it's kind of fed that curiosity, I guess, over time.
I think a lot of times people who become interested in true crime either have a family experience in something to a greater or lesser degree, somebody in their family is a crime victim, or you're right, they read about somebody, they heard about somebody at a relatively early age, and they became really interested in kind of the criminal mind or the dark side of human nature.
Especially when the adults won't tell you what they're talking about. You know.
Yes. Yeah. Which, yeah, we all know that is not a good strategy.
That never works. That never works.
That your kids know about. Yeah. And they're looking for what's going on.
Yeah. You listen to mom and dad, it's your fault.
Yeah.
I mean that in a good way. and going deeper in, I don't want to give away a bunch out of the book, but also there's so many important layers to it. When you get into, you know, you get into the psychology, the motivations, how they're built, but you go into things that victims can do. You go into impacts on families and mm-hmm. how that affects. I think very importantly, you lay out, you know, tactics, sort of, you know, the one of the questions is, you know, how do you escape? How do you survive or mm-hmm. serial killer? And you lay it out very plainly. You don't give up, and you don't let your, you know, keeping your ears open. But then you also go into the laying out how a family is hurt by this. And it's a long drive. Like you said, grief is forever, yeah. But you laid out a statistic that for every one victim, there's 7 to 10, second level victims laid in there, and it just exponentially grows. So I know
it really is tragic because it is easy. You and I are talking about true crime and having this kind of love-hate relationship sometimes with it, because, you know, how important it is to tell these stories with compassion and respect for the victims. And it's amazing to me, you know, when you talk to victims and their families, number one, just the devastation that does, it's like a ripple effect. You know, it affects a community, it affects the immediate family, it affects the church, it affects the workplace. I mean, people feel less safe, you know, even if you didn't know that person. So it just has a ripple effect. And at the same time, one of the things I really wanted to talk about in the book is just the courage that you see among people who've survived, for example, who are willing to get up and testify and look somebody in the face, and just families who, you know, hound the police, go to the media, you know, just determined to find out what happened to their loved one. It's so phenomenal to me to see that.
Yeah, that survivor spirit I forget which one it was. It was a girl in Charleston. I remember, because I was already gone by then. You know, you talked about the victim in Charleston who guy has a drop on her with a gun. She disturbs him enough that he fumbles for it. She picks it up and lays him out. And and it's just never given up. That's just it. But that's just an ancillary point, but is there best practices that you've found through your researching these questions of victim response or you can't say victim precipitation, but conditions that one can avoid to survive, I guess, so to speak?
I mean, the main takeaway that I found, which was actually pretty grim in some respects, but the main takeaway I came away with in this one study that was done in Germany was that you can't get in the car. You know, you cannot be, you know, you've got to do, it's better to fight than ever to comply. And that the odds of you surviving by complying, even when somebody has a gun or a knife, the odds of you surviving go so far down. And that was pretty disheartening for me to read that. But it's also at the same time very clear. This guy really did, from Germany, kind of take all these different, you know, cases and kind of go, okay, if somebody is to survive, how do we increase the odds? And we all know people who, you know, when you get scared or you're threatened, we want to freeze, or somebody says, I got this gun, get in the car, or this knife or whatever. I mean, who wouldn't understand somebody just kind of, you know, letting them put the ties behind your back? And sometimes we can't avoid those things, but it was so stark. Like I said, the findings just were, again, you know, the findings were that your odds of surviving just go way down when you are in somebody's control. And you're confined in some respects. And so, you know, there, unfortunately, there was no like, okay, so do this. You know, it was just more like fight, do whatever you can, but that's your best chance.
Yep. Yeah. I also noticed some very recent studies of victimology here in the States that I'm horrible with names, but you laid out a couple studies of, you know, somebody trying to see if you can get somebody into a van, and then the amount of college kids they actually got to go with strangers for money, or even allow themselves to be bound up at some point.
Yeah. it's terrifying, isn't it? I mean, it really is. I wish I could think of that study as well. I can't, but I know there was I think it was on the Today Show actually, where they went out and, you know, gave all these lessons to these kids about safety and stranger danger and all kinds of things. And then they had, oh gosh, I can't remember. He was from the Today Show, I think, who did this experiment. Is this ringing a bell, John?
Like, yeah, like, it is. I was, oh, okay. Hold on a second. As I was reading it, Hofstra University was one, 2014, Jeff Rosen partnership with Hofstra University.
Yep.
They did this training. This is what to look out for, you know, basically citizens watch type training. Don't, you know, keep your head on a swivel. Mm-hmm. And then they showed up with a van, which that should be a red flag by one, right? Creepy cargo van.
Nothing good happens in a van.
Creepy cargo vans aren't cool anymore. Stop watching Dazed and Confused. But yeah, there was so many kids that they actually got. Oh yeah, for some money, they jump in the van, go downtown.
Yes.
And that was it. That's statistically speaking, you just walked right through the gate. You just handed yourself to them.
Yeah, that is. Yeah, I remember that study so clearly, and it was so. I mean, it was so disturbing to, you know, to parents and the kids who are watching this. You know, and it's kind of like, what do we do? And there's all kinds of potential explanations. One of them being that we still have this, we as in younger kids still have this idea that bad guys look ugly. You know what I mean? Bad guys look like bad guys. They have horns or, it's just so difficult because developmentally, you know, we think about kids and how they see the world or whatever. It's just hard to think of them being able to understand that and navigate that in any kind of useful way.
Yeah. But as a parent though, it's just god awful frightening thinking of, yeah.
It really is. It, like you said, I mean, can you imagine seeing one of those parents? You've just sit down and read them the riot act about safety and all this, and then they go out and you think about peers. And I mean, there's just so many variables that parents can't control, you know, peer pressure and, you know, the sense of like all kids have, which is, you know, I'll live forever. Nothing bad will ever happen to me, et cetera, et cetera. And some of that, I just think as parents, and I know you have much younger kids than I do, sometimes you just have to hold your breath and jump with faith into, you know, do what you can. And, but it's just, that study was terrifying. And they showed it. Remember, they've showed this on the Today Show or with Jeff Rosin. It really was scary.
Yep. Yeah. And they're college kids that at this point in 2013, they've probably all grown up with Discovery ID. What are you doing?
Yeah, exactly. So. No. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking, I actually read an article one time that says, here's why your daughter should be a true crime fan. Because my poor girls, I have 19 and 21. It's like, sometimes I think they're going to be walking through the world with some kind of stealth gun, you know, because I'm like sending them things like, oh, there's finger polish now that you can put your hand in, just make sure it's safe. And I think there's a good part of that. But then I think sometimes, are they going to be scarred for life? Like, well, you can't trust anybody in the world, you know? So finding that balance is hard.
Yep. Yeah. That's being in a crowd trying to wrangle a 9-year-old and a 4-year-old and walking through a crowded place or like a busy theme park or something. And the wife will say something, and I'll just not even acknowledge. And she, Matt, what, you're not even listening to me. I'm like, well, I'm sorry. I'm so busy trying to figure out how many of these people are trying to kidnap a kid.
Because we know it's one of them.
They're one of them. Yeah.
That's so funny. Man. That's so true though. It is. I know.
Yep. Oh yeah. Paranoia is a good thing sometimes, I guess.
Yeah.
Let's
just call it hypersensitivity. Yeah, when we know it's paranoia.
Yeah. Yeah. I swear everybody, I'm not that crazy, but you know, if I don't listen to you in a crowded place, there's probably a reason, you know.
When it's your kids, I mean, it's like, it's not crazy. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's legit.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like we could probably talk for 6 hours just on the book. There's so much into it, and it's such a great premise of you collecting the questions that come from your reader group for over time and diving in and explaining them out in such an easy to digest way. I love that book. I was bouncing all over that thing.
Well, I'm thrilled. And like I said, I'm always happy to come back on if you want to do it again sometime. So I know it's great. I really enjoyed it a lot.
Well, I look forward. Is there anything next? What are you working on next? I mean, outside of the 30 other things you got going on.
Well, that's the problem. You know, I think I've got like it's not ADHD for real. It's just more like writing. You know, it's specific to writing. So I have several projects that are kind of on. I mean, I keep my column going and, you know, keep those things that I'm always doing. But then, I'm still... Yeah, I'm not sure. I've got so many projects in the works that I think I'm just going to need to kind of parse it down a little bit and focus. I like the shiny new object. I don't know about you, if you ever feel that way. Let's do something else. You know, now that you've done all this research, just like, I'm done with that. You know, so I'm working on that, being more, focused and completing things. So it's up in the air, I guess.
Yeah, it's like you do the research. It's like, oh, question's answered. I'm good.
Exactly.
Wait a minute.
We're just getting started.
Yeah.
That's so true. Yeah.
Yeah. Nobody else knows the answer yet.
Exactly.
Exactly. Wow. But we've been going probably a little over an hour now. I don't want to keep you. It's a, you know, it's Tuesday night. You've got dozens of animals to look after.
I do. Yes.
Yeah. You've got your YouTube channel, your podcast, is social media. Any social media links you want to share?
No, I think I don't know if it's social media. I do a Substack newsletter, which is sure it's free. And I think that's kind of fun because I try to keep up with the more recent cases. And then I mentioned Unmasking a Murder, which is my YouTube channel, and then LinkedIn. I don't do a lot. I haven't done a lot of Instagram. I've flirted with TikTok, but I haven't really made a move on it. I've heard it's fantastic things for books and all that. I do a few of them and then I just kind of get, so that I think I've pretty, and then my website is drjonijohnston.com. That's pretty easy. So those are the main ways, I guess, to communicate.
Well, you're always invited back here. Cause like I said, we scratched the surface on this thing. There's tons of stuff. I'm jealous of your job. So
well, thank you. And yeah. Like I said, anytime. Yeah. So,
well, I appreciate it. Thank you for joining me. And everybody, thank you for joining us tonight. And I'll be back next week. Have a good night.